Good evening and welcome to Outsources, a weekly KGNU program that provides you with content related to queer communities in Colorado. I'm your host, Elise Matital, and for this week's episode, I tried something different and interviewed my dad. I was inspired by our host, Stoney Burtz's interview with Dr. Kumar about the Colorado Springs LGBTQ Oral History Project, and decided to conduct my own oral history interview with my dad, Bob Matital. For context, I was born and raised in Denver and learned about my dad's identity when I was in high school, right before he moved to Seattle, where he's lived for the last few years. When I came out in grad school as queer, he was one of my biggest supporters. 30 minutes certainly wasn't enough time to cover his or all of the things we wanted to talk about, but his story is definitely still worth a listen. Before we get started, do you want to introduce yourself, name, pronouns, a little bit about you?
He, him. My name is Robert George Matital. I grew up in the same room from the day I was born till the week I graduated from high school in Weymouth, Mass. And then my folks moved to Plymouth to be near my stepbrother. So I lived in the two oldest towns in Weymouth, Puritan pilgrim history. And kind of affected where I came from. And then I went to undergraduate school in Indiana and was surrounded by cornfields and conservatism and wonderful family values, but way different than sort of the hustle and bustle of being 15 miles outside of Boston. From there, I went back to Boston. My parents were older. My dad was 48 when I was born, my mom 41. And when I was young, I was always kind of plagued with, hey, I could go at any minute. And they made it to 90 and 91, and I had friends, older friends, that advised me that I should live my life, because if they lived to 100 and I didn't live my life the way I wanted to, I'd be pretty pissed by the time I hit 60, which is about where I am right now. And so I stayed there for a little while, and then they moved to Florida, and I applied to graduate school and came here to Colorado, went to UCD for architecture and urban planning.
University of Colorado, Denver?
Yes, UCD. And loved it. I had a kind of personal transformation that changed my approach to things. I had studied landscape architecture at Purdue, and everything was about plants. I had my own landscape company as a kid in high school, doing people's yards and things. But I did an Outward Bound course in the Canyonlands in Moab as a replacement for, what would I call it? I was going to join the National Guard in Massachusetts to pay for school. And I had friends advise me, Bob, you're no warrior. So unless you want to come back with some PTSD, try something else. And I wanted to do basic training just to see how good a shape I could get in. And I was a Boy Scout as a kid, so the outdoors was important to me early on. So I did this Canyonlands trip and had an epiphany that I was way more into rocks than I was plants at the time. So I switched my major to architecture and came out here. And then because I'm a fairly gregarious person, being an only child in terms of growing up, I got stuck in a lot of the situations where I was dealing with people more than buildings, and I became more of a planner. So having the two, I became kind of an urban designer, and always wanted to be in the mountains, and managed to do my thesis in Telluride, and then got hired to work there. And I put off finishing my thesis for about 3 years. And in order to be focused and get it done, I threw a futon in the back of my Nissan Pathfinder and slept in the back of the car behind KC Furniture over by the old McNichols Arena. And I would be the first person into the gym to go for a swim in the morning and then into the studio. The intention was to stay in the studio, but they wouldn't let us where other schools had that I'd seen in trips. So I ended up doing that and spent all of my extra time and money in a yoga school where I met your mother. Ironically, I've always wanted to live in Seattle since I was 18, but my parents wouldn't let me go to school west of the Mississippi, so Indiana was as far as I could get. And then this time period when I was in Boston, I fell in love with Pam, a classical harpist, and she wanted to move out west too. So we came out to Colorado, and during that time, I was kind of her Sherpa, a little pickup truck, and drove her around to all her gigs while I was in grad school. So lived pretty well off of the entertainment that she was providing. And then when I got to the yoga school, I overheard your mom say that she was from Seattle, which is what made me initially say hello and say, let's go get a cup of coffee. And we immediately connected. It was kind of like the irony of being silent in a yoga school for 3 or 4 months, 2 or 3 times a week. So I kind of knew your mom, but without ever talking to her. And I think she thought I was a lot more quiet than I was based on that experience, and found out differently later. But unfortunately to my dream of Seattle, but fortunately to having you in my life, we fell in love, and I couldn't get to Seattle for another 25 years or so. And then when the crash happened in 2008, I was working for a design firm in downtown, and there was no work for architects, and it was an opportunity for me to, you know, go to Seattle. And so I did, had a friend that lived out there and helped me out during that downturn.
So you're currently in Seattle.
Yeah. So now I live in Seattle, and I'm in love again, and have a semi-grandson and daughter-in-law, even though I'm not married. Getting to experience and continue towards the dream that I've always had of being able to design and build properties that give me an understanding. So I have an apartment in Fremont neighborhood in Seattle, which is about 3 blocks from one of the lakes that opens up to the view of downtown, so I'm about a mile from downtown. And then Martha has a house up in Edmonds, which is ironically very similar to how I grew up in Boston, suburb close to the city. And it's a ferry town, which is kind of interesting. The ferries go in and out, so a lot of people travel through there. And she just retired, and we're kind of building a next era life together, and it's going pretty well. So we just finished turning her basement into an apartment, and we have a tenant that can take care of the house. And we have 5 acres of land in a totally rural area. So this allows me to experience urban, suburban, and rural life all while kind of following Wendell Berry's idea of stewarding a piece of property as a way to love the land and get to know the area rather than just read about it.
Can you share a little bit about your identity?
Sure. I would consider myself bisexual, but I'm learning more about vocabulary related to things, and sort of grappling with pansexuality as an idea and an identity. And I consider, because architecture is about creating a story about something that doesn't exist yet and convincing people to build something that they can't see, I've always been fascinated with that. And falling in love with your mom and understanding all the psychology that goes along with you and your sister and her was a new learning experience for me that adapted into a lot of this. So the idea of creating identity is an ongoing thing for me that has been more conscious than I think a lot of the people that I know that just do their life without kind of self-reflecting. Mm-hmm. So when I was younger, my dad, because he was older, worked the same job for 35 years, kind of grinding in the corporate world. But he had had a traumatic experience where his first wife and child died in childbirth. And this was back in the 30s. And he literally got a phone call at 2 a.m. that they were gone. And he wasn't there. That wasn't the case. Normally back then, you didn't hang out in the hospital like you do now. He also had to stay home, didn't go to the war, was a single dad. My brother was 10 at the time. So he dropped out of architecture school, didn't get to follow his dream. And so there was a certain level of over-involvement with me that he kind of wanted me to follow that. Even at a young age, I can remember being 5 years old and me giving a compass and T-square as a toy. And so there was some alcoholism that was always contained. He was a really hard worker, but there was this 50s mentality of all of his friends had gone off to World War II and he didn't go. He stayed home. And so his idea of parenting was being a drill instructor. And he was sit on me all the time. And there was this conscious balance of things. But I definitely digested a lot of his negativity around that, but always knew that he loved me and that he had issues that he wasn't dealing with. There was emotional abuse when I was younger, when he was also exhausted at 60, having to work three different shifts to make up for people because he was the elder at his job. And I found solace and became connected emotionally and physically. My first sort of love was my best friend who lived three houses down the street. And because I was an only child, I learned early on how to weasel my way into big families and have that kind of atmosphere. So I learned early on how to be alone, but I was always lonely. And irony, my parents were retired and they would take us on vacations, but didn't want to have to deal with a kid by himself. So they brought my friend with me and we would have our own hotel room and our own cabins and things like that. And we got closer and closer and closer. And when senior year of high school happened, we were all talking about college and where we were going to go. And he was in a car accident with one of my best friends. She was driving and got hit by a drunk driver who drove through a red light. He was pinned up against a pole and immediately brain dead and in a coma for the next 15 years. And growing up in New England, which has tends to have a history of Judeo-Christian guilt and worry, at 18, I thought that he had that accident because we were sinning. So I had to go through a whole analysis and grappling with my religious identity, which had been surrounded by Puritanism, essentially. And I had chosen to go to a school in an incredibly conservative state where you couldn't talk about anything. So for the next couple of years, I would be visiting the hospital to see him and not able to tell his family or her family that we were as close as we were, that I could forgive her for, you know, the accident, which she took very personally. And so I would spend Christmas Eves when I came home with both of these families, not being able to talk about it and couldn't express it to my parents either. So that was a huge kind of smack to my head, but it allowed me or forced me to go through, I think, a set of growth and kind of analysis that I wouldn't have done otherwise. And so I've always had an interest in psychology, even though that's never been my field. And I sort of kind of get that through other people like you guys. And it's been really wonderful. But for about 20 years, I had no contact with other men sexually or romantically. But not knowing it, I've developed an ability to go beyond the normal male homophobia that I grew up with. And develop close friendships where I would say I could acknowledge the fact that I was attracted to somebody because of whatever they were. And that's why I wanted to be friends. And as I got older, I started to realize, well, why would I want to pick any friend that I didn't like? So I essentially fell in love with my friends and that they became my closest bonded friend for a different era. Could be somebody I worked with, a fraternity brother, that sort of thing. And so this evolved into a parallel identity change where later on when I was here, I found Quakers and started hanging out with them and liked their history, liked that they walked the talk in a million different ways. First group to refuse the draft, things like that. And so that helped me also be more accepting of differences and hold on to and discern things that I didn't understand yet. And so I grew up back east where there's a lot of energy, a lot of people mixing, and I learned to be sort of verbally abusive to people. But since the other person was too, it was considered, okay. And I never learned to pick and choose when to be a certain energy. And so I've learned that through hard lessons that, the divorce from your mom, other situations like that that I own of what I brought into the conflict. So it's been an ongoing process that's totally tied into my sexuality. And then after a second divorce, because of that same dilemma of what I picked up from my dad, I was overlapping that with a difficult divorce and the economic crisis. And I had become HIV positive and went through a period of about a year or two where I, how would I describe it? Didn't question my mortality, just assumed that I was going to die. So became more involved with risky behavior, meeting people that I wouldn't have otherwise met through dating and that sort of thing. But also became much more opened up to the whole spectrum of humanity. And it fed my Quakerism of treating everybody with dignity, respect, no matter what their situation is, and the equality of human beings, no matter what socioeconomic, race, location they came from. And because of where I was at the situation, I had sort of this empathy with different groups that I didn't even realize in terms of who I was picking to be with and that sort of thing.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver. I'm your host, Elise Matitol, and you've been listening to an oral history interview with my dad, Bob Matitol.
That then flowed into getting cancer and being a stage 4B Hodgkin's lymphoma patient. Who I didn't realize how sick I was until you and I met my oncologist together, and I introduced him, and he had said, "Boy, we almost lost your dad a couple of times there." And so that was kind of a wake-up call for me. But all the cliches about cancer are true. You know, you reassess things, and you live in the moment more, and you take things much more in an aware way. You don't take things for granted anymore. So that actually was a blessing. And I was lucky that I never really felt any pain. I just went through the troughs of 16 rounds of chemo and had wonderful caretakers, and was kind of amazed that I was referred to my doctor by my nurse practitioner, who is a lesbian in a community clinic that dealt with a lot of the LGBTQ community in Capitol Hill in Seattle. And my oncologist actually had a 20-year specialty in HIV. And so the irony of that was that he had actually been the director of Bailey Boucher in Seattle, which is the very first nursing home for AIDS patients in the United States before New York or San Francisco. And so he and I became friends through a combination of things, where I finally was feeling healthy enough after four rounds of chemo to look up his curriculum vitae and found out that he was from Michigan, where you went to grad school, and that he had been there at the exact same time that I was at Purdue. So we started talking about football, and there was a football game where Michigan was number one in the country, and Purdue beat him with a field goal in the last 10 seconds. So I asked him, "Do you remember that game?" And he goes, "Not only do I remember that game, I went to high school with the kid that kicked the field goal for you guys." So we became pretty good friends and spent a lot of time getting to know each other through sports talk. And so I learned that if I trusted him as my doctor, and I would ask what my numbers were at the first 5 minutes, and then I would spend the next 20 minutes talking golf, baseball, and football with him.
Can you clarify what you mean by your numbers?
Yeah. So, you know, you get both your HIV numbers, your CD4 count, and your viral load. And when you're a chemo patient, you're essentially an AIDS patient. You have no immune system. So my white blood cell count would vary constantly, and I would have to get blood transfusions to bring that up. And the first few rounds, I just didn't understand the nadir. So what you do is you get a steroid at the beginning, and you're literally up for 2 days, and you get everything you need done in those 2 days. And then all of a sudden you get whacked, and you just are exhausted, and you're literally laid up in bed for about 2 or 3 days. And then you start to feel better again. And once you do, they do it all over again. And so this was my life for about a year and a half. And I was living south of town, and I had a roommate. It was my first gay roommate, where I actually lived sort of in the gay community and was socializing on a daily basis. Doing therapy over time, one of the things that came up was I was homophobic, but about myself and not about other people. And so that actually was part of my identity challenge of what is masculinity and what do I own and what do I like and say, no, I'm good at that. That helps me. And how do I use that to benefit other people? You know, so anyways, I had done Donald's Basement, who was a 70-year-old gay man who had been married and had 3 kids and grandchildren. I ended up fixing his bathroom after meeting him at a party, and did a remodel, you know, marble walls, and took out his bathtub and installed a shower. And he let me stay there for about 3 months. So when I got cancer several years later, he was about a mile from my hospital. And he goes, why don't you just move in? I've got the room open, and I'm not going to get I need another roommate. And we lived through a construction project with no bathroom. Cancer will be a breeze. And so I did, and I turned his living room into an infirmary with his big screen TV and started watching the Food Network. And it was wonderful. I actually have to say I have fond memories of my time with cancer in spite of it. The best story of that was the first weekend was the AIDS walk on Capitol Hill. And I had an infusion appointment, and the buses were shut down and I couldn't get there. It was an absolute Seattle downpour, and I had to walk in the rain 2.5 miles, and I was an hour late for my appointment. And so I show up and go, I couldn't get here because of an AIDS fundraiser, even though I'm an HIV positive patient. So that was kind of hilarious. And all of a sudden, a social worker came out and gave me a stack of vouchers to take cabs to and from all of my treatments after that.
I feel like you've touched on this a little bit with like Bailey Boucher, and I know you participate with Lifelong, which is a community center for HIV positive folks, right?
Well, it's more like a service organization. They have case managers that help you with housing, that get you insurance, they connect you up with doctors. They have a thing called Will Call, where you can get tickets to events that are donated. And so while you're going through treatments and things like that, it's pretty difficult to work. And so this is a baseline safety net support system that doesn't exist in our healthcare system right now and needed to be created. It's interesting to go through this pandemic and have enough history to see what it was like to go through that pandemic and to know people that lost people just because there was no services. People wouldn't even, the government wouldn't even speak the term for.
Do you mean the AIDS epidemic?
AIDS epidemic, yeah.
I guess I'm curious what community and what queer community means to you.
Well, an interesting thing that I was just thinking about recently in Seattle is Capitol Hill was the gay community in town. And Seattle is growing rapidly like Colorado and Denver. And the economics of real estate have transformed that, and it's been taken over by tech kids with money. They're building a lot of new apartments and displacing a lot of the artists and lower income apartments. So the counseling service that provides therapy, and this group is another one of these service providers that started out as the only place that would deal with LGBTQ people at a time that it was really traumatic for a lot of people. And we get a lot of young kids that move to Seattle that are grappling with their identity and have literally been kicked out of their home by supposedly Christian families in the Midwest and the South, and they end up on the streets. have no street savvy, are nice kids, but don't know what to do or how to get a foothold. And so there's several groups that help them out. So this counseling service is one of them. They've since moved to downtown in an area that's high-rise office buildings. And when I talked to my therapist recently, what we talked about was there is no gay neighborhood per se in Seattle anymore, because Seattle is so welcoming that there's gay couples that buy houses in suburbia everywhere. There's stuff all over the city. There's theater groups that do gay themed plays and identity issue plays in whatever space they can find. So they're not in a gay ghetto anymore. It's now the whole city is available as it should be. And it reminded me of the conversation that we had when I introduced you to my therapist, James, and you talked about the book Beyond Gay. And the idea at the time was that everybody's trying to get equality. And once you get it, you don't need to use labels. You're just a person. And so that was kind of a milestone for me, having that conversation. And it made me realize just how much work you've done related to things.
I guess that leads into my next question of, would you consider yourself like a queer elder?
Well, I've gotten to the point where I don't want to consider myself an elder, but everybody else does. So I guess I have to own being 65, but in my head, I still think I'm 20. I can do all the stuff that I haven't yet done. And I would say yes. I do a lot of volunteer work when I can. I was the caretaker at my Quaker meeting, and they're an incredibly open space for LGBTQ people. They were a homeless site where people slept in the sanctuary at night and then would leave in the morning. So that connection helped me do that in other ways. And I've volunteered for Lifelong, volunteered for Bailey Boucher at times. And then also Martha is incredibly involved in all sorts of volunteer stuff. And as a nurse practitioner, her history was literally being in the emergency rooms in the Upper West Side of New York during the AIDS epidemic. I've been able to be that kind of elder within her community too. So yeah, I would say yes. I can't help but have conversations with younger people that becomes warnings or shared stories that say, well, this is where I went and what I did. Maybe you can try it differently because I don't want you to have to deal with what I had to do with, that sort of thing. So yeah, I would say yes. I mean, at this age, as a parent, as a growing into being a grandparent, can't help be an elder to everybody else. You learn a lot as a parent, and then you have this next stage in your life where you want to share those skills with the world in some way.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are very over time, so I'm going to stop us here unless there's any last thoughts that you want to share.
Yeah, I just want to say how much of an honor and a pleasure it is to get to do this with you during the week that I'm back here, to share your birthday next week and have sort of a holiday season get together. So this is sort of the Christmas show.
You've been listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver. I'm Elise Matitol, and this was an oral history interview with my dad, Bob Matitol, a reluctant queer elder and former Colorado transplant. For a very cute photo of us and more information about the show, visit news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about today's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org. Join us next week, Monday at 6:30 p.m. for another episode of Outsources, providing you homegrown queer radio every week. That's Monday, 6:30 p.m. right here on KGNU, or listen anytime after the broadcast at kgnu.org/outsources.